Hi, I'm Sophie, and this is Age Well with Dr. Sophie Schotter, a space where, together with my producer Fee, I talk to good friends and trusted experts on how they age well, whether it's their latest supplement stack, what's on their bathroom shelf, or a new biohacking device that really seems to work. Because for me, aging well is all about looking and feeling like the best possible version of ourselves, both inside as well as out. Remember, you can also find even more ideas and expert tips on my social channels at Dr. Sophie Schotter. I'd love you to come and join me over there too. So this is my show. Welcome along. As always, thank you so much for listening.
And this week, Fee and I are in conversation with Dr. Zoe Williams.
Zoe, you're a practicing GP, but you also have a hugely successful media career. You're the resident GP on ITV's This Morning. You present on different shows across the BBC, from The One Show to the brilliant Trust Me, I'm a Doctor. You're host of the Clear Minds podcast. You hold several non-clinical roles, including National Advisor for Public Health England. You founded the non-profit ActiveLink, alongside which you also raise funds for several charities, including the Sweaty Betty Foundation, which encourages girls into sport. And last year, you published your fabulous book, You Grow Girl, The Complete No Worries Guide to Growing Up, which I love because it's such a difficult time for so many. You also write a weekly GP health advice column for the Sun newspaper, and you're clearly a doting mum to your little boy. So my first question is perhaps an obvious one, but I'm genuinely curious, how do you keep all of those plates spinning?
Gosh, I think when you reel it all off like that, it does sound like a lot, doesn't it? And I think, to be honest, the brutally honest answer is sometimes I don't. Sometimes I do drop some plates. And I think what I've discovered in life is that as long as it's not that you're not concentrating when you're seeing a patient, because then that could be serious. But, you know, generally, it's not the end of the world. So I think I've always spoken about, there's this term work-life balance, which tells us that we should be having a sensible ratio of how much time we spend working and how much time we spend living. But I think for me, my work is my life, part of it. So it's more about having a work-work balance. And I definitely find that I thrive with change, with all these things going on at once, whilst it is sometimes difficult to keep them all spinning. I definitely don't thrive working 9 to 5, Monday to Friday, kind of like I used to when I was a full-time GP, just doing that. It's not good for me. Routine is not really good for everybody. And I probably could do with a little bit more routine, but actually I thrive with chaos.
And mixing it up a little bit. Hello, yeah. Zoe. We saw a lovely little video clip of a photo shoot you did for Hello Magazine a while back, and your lovely partner, Stuart, who bought you tea and crumpets for breakfast. Is that your usual breakfast? And also, we're curious, what's your usual morning routine, including your relationship with your phone and checking emails, which links into what Sophie just asked?
Yeah, so, well, firstly, my usual breakfast, it varies from time to time. I think that tea and crumpets is a lovely breakfast because I'm not a morning person. Yeah. I hate the mornings. I'm a night owl, a true, true night owl. I really struggle to get myself in bed before midnight, but I don't fully function until about 12 o'clock. So for me, something comforting in the morning, like a crumpet and a cup of tea. But I think probably when that video was taken, I was probably still breastfeeding, so trying to keep it low on the caffeine. Typically, I usually have a cup of coffee first thing and then a cup of tea shortly afterwards. Mm. I'm not eating breakfast at the moment because I'm doing the intermittent fasting thing, doing a bit of keto as well. This is not necessarily a diet that I promote or say everyone should do, but for me and Stuart, it works really well. A couple of times a year, we do a month or so of keto, which kind of just helps us reset. So yeah, so no breakfast at the morning, just a cup of coffee. But yeah. At the weekends, that's when I love to have a good all-out breakfast, get the bacon going, get the eggs on.
Yeah.
I do enjoy eating breakfast, but I used to find it really difficult to skip breakfast because I am a breakfast person. But yeah, it's funny how quickly your body gets used to it and I don't really think about it now. I wouldn't say I do go straight to my phone. I'm normally woken up by my toddler screaming, "Mummy." So I tend to go and get in his bed and we have a little cuddle in the morning. And then, yeah, I tend to focus on getting him sorted before I distract my mind with work. So our morning routine is I get him up, get his breakfast, get him ready while Stuart sorts himself out, and then Stuart does the nursery drop off. So it's not until they've walked out of the door, I've tidied up the breakfast stuff, that I really pick up my phone. But until 9 o'clock in the morning, nobody's expecting me to respond or do anything. So unless I've got an early start, I probably don't pick up my phone till 9 o'clock.
But I do love the idea of crumpets for breakfast. You've just reminded me of how great crumpets are. So thank you for that.
As a GP, you've talked about helping patients manage their health in a more holistic way, which I think Peter Attia talks about medicine 2.0 and 3.0. And I think this is the way we all have to move. We all know the big cornerstones by now. So a fiber-rich diet to support gut health, good sleep, plenty of exercise, ideally little to no alcohol. But what else do you do that's really made a tangible difference to your health beyond those kind of, I say, obvious things? Many people still don't understand their importance. So for example, if we look at nutritional supplements, do you take any? And if so, what products and brands have really worked for you? And I noticed in another interview, you mentioned breath work and also a manifestation type of chant. Are you still into these kinds of things?
So I think like most people, I cycle through and try lots of various different methods and techniques. And yeah, I love listening to people like Peter Attia and his knowledge and wisdom. But even he changes his mind from time to time. So, you know, the prolonged fasting is something that he was a real advocate of, but he wasn't able to maintain his muscle mass whilst doing it. So I think we really do have to take everything with a cup of tea and recognise that what works for one person doesn't work for another. And a big thing that we often forget about, I think, when we're talking about these trends is agency. And the population I work with as a GP, these are people who realistically are not going to do an ice bath in the morning. They're not going to eat 5 portions of fruit and veg a day. That is just not going to happen for some of my patients. I work in Peckham in a very deprived area of London, and I'm trying to get patients to eat 1 portion of fruit or veg a day, and that for them is a win. So we forget sometimes about agency, and in some ways, Dr. Rangan Chatterjee has just brought out his latest book, and it's a different theme for him. It's all about understanding yourself and your own limitations and what you can do. And he invited me to the book launch dinner last week, and it just really resonated. What he was saying is, yes, education and knowledge is great, but there's so much knowledge out there now. There's so much education. Like, if you want to read, listen to a podcast, read a book, go online, there's so much education. We don't have a lack of education anymore. People just have a lack of ability to often put healthy practices, even just eating enough fruit and veg, into practice because they don't have agency, because their lives are too difficult. So when I think about my own routines and the things that I've done, yeah, at one point I was going to Buddhist meetings and was chanting Nam-myoho Renge Kyo. There'll be a lot of people out there perhaps who know about that. And then there was another time that I was doing meditative practice regularly. But I really struggle to keep it up consistently because, as you mentioned at the minute, I've got so many things going on, so many plates spinning, that the truth is I could do it, but they don't get to the top of my priority list, so they don't happen. And when I had a baby, you know, when I first had a newborn, I really struggled with the newborn stage. I didn't do any of it. I think getting out for a daily walk a day, if I could do that, then boom, I'd done well. So I think, yeah, with these trends, I'm not a huge advocate of anything other than the basic things like high fiber diet, getting lots of fruit and veg, regularly exercising, trying to get good sleep, managing your stress, eliminating toxic things like too much alcohol, smoking, etc. Outside of those sort of pillars of lifestyle medicine, I think all the other stuff is really interesting and really fascinating, but sometimes less is more. And I think a good bit of advice for people is to focus on, whilst these things can benefit you, focus on the things that you want to do, enjoy doing, and don't try and do too much of it because it's not sustainable.
I completely agree that picking the things that work for you and doing them consistently is far more important than trying to do everything and actually getting none of it done.
Yeah, exactly. Sometimes people ask me about exercise, you know, what's the best time of day to exercise? What's the best form of exercise? And the bottom line is, it doesn't matter. What's most important is that you create an exercise regime that you will stick to. Because as you said, Sophie, spot on, consistency. So the best time to exercise, if I was forced to say, which never happens for me because I'm not a morning person, but it would be first thing in the morning before the rest of your day. Because the later you leave it in the day, the more the things that happen in your day can jump in front and take priority. And that means that the exercise doesn't happen. So the only way to really be consistent is to do whatever your lifestyle practice is that's most important to you first thing in the morning before anything else can interfere with it.
You know, this morning, every day, Monday to Friday at 7 a.m, I'm training, doing something different.
And I totally admire that, because I am not. I'm in bed.
I don't have children. So that I'm more of a morning person. So I find I'm at my best first thing in the day.
Do you take supplements though, Zoe?
I take a multivitamin and I take vitamin D and I take a omega-3. So sensible, basic supplements. And I've tried collagen for a period of time, but wasn't overly convinced, if I'm honest. Doing what I do, I often get gifted things, so I try them. But the one thing that I felt different with was the functional mushrooms. I'm into that. I'm really interested in that. I went to a cafe somewhere in, I think it was in Kensington, and you could order your coffee with the dirty functional mushrooms. So I thought, oh, let's give it a go. So obviously didn't know it was a difference from one dose of it, but was a bit intrigued. So started researching it. And then I started following them. So then they said, oh, do you want to send you some? And they did. So I took it consistently for about a month. And I really felt, I felt like a little bit sharper in the morning. I found the mornings easier. And I just felt like I had a bit more clarity of thought. But it was a noticeable difference. And I've never had that with any other supplement that I've taken. I've been trusted that maybe I'm getting some benefit from it. But yeah, that's the only thing I've ever taken where I felt a noticeable difference. And I've never worked with them. I've never been paid by them. I'd like to, if they're listening. but I definitely felt different.
I think they're fabulous as well. I take their Lion's Mane every day, which I really rate. I think they're a fantastic range of supplements. I think I first encountered them judging some awards, because I do quite a lot of, it was probably something like the Get the Gloss Wellness Awards. And I think they're a fantastic brand, and mushrooms are so underrated still.
And yeah, Sophie, I think you've done a couple of episodes on mushrooms, including, of course, our microdosing episode with Mums on Mushrooms, but that's a whole nother conversation.
Whole nother story.
Maybe,
those types of mushrooms.
Oh, no. That's a different. We've done one on more functional mushrooms. We've done one on mushrooms in skincare. And we've talked about microdosing as well.
Yeah.
But so all in separate episodes.
Yeah. We'll link into them. What you were saying, Zoe, about timing and doing exercise, for example, at the best time that's right for your body, that kind of links into my next question, because Sophie and I also did a fascinating episode on at-home health test kits. And one of the things that we did was DNA testing, which told us things like, this is your unique body, this is what's exactly right for you, including exercise and whether we're prone to injuries or not, and all these kinds of things. Have you ever done any of these at-home health test kits? And if so, how did you find them? Or would you ever do any of them?
The only one I've done actually was a hair analysis. And not to look at my genetics or anything, actually to analyse my hair to find out what type of hair I have and what types of products and how best to manage it. So having afro hair, I know people who have very similar texture of hair to mine. It looks the same, yet the products that we use and benefit from are completely different, because it's all about how porous your hair is, et cetera, et cetera. So I once did that, but otherwise, not really. I sort of asked myself the question. So I find it interesting and fascinating, and I love listening to other people's experiences about using these test kits. And I haven't listened to that episode, but I will definitely listen to it, because I did see on the show notes that you tested all sorts of stuff. But I think I always ask myself the question, firstly, is the information useful? Well, I understand it, and I know I have a bit of a head start because I'm a doctor, so the chances are I will understand it, but will it change anything? Will it put anything into action? And I think often I know that the results are going to tell me that I should probably be getting better sleep, maybe moving a bit more, maybe eating a bit more fiber or more diverse ranges of fiber. And I think, how valuable is that information, especially because I know I'm not doing enough exercise at the moment. I know I could be eating better. I know at certain times, especially over Christmas, I'm probably drinking too much. So I almost feel like until I've got those things sorted, like the low-hanging fruit, the big stuff that I don't need a test to tell me I'll benefit from, am I really going to start, you know, including more of a certain type of food? Probably not. So is it a bit of a waste of time and energy? And also our brains are so full of, so I wear a Garmin to analyze my sleep, movement, hydration, all sorts of various different stuff, heart rate variability. And I think, well, okay, well, how often do I actually, I always look at my sleep data, but how often do I really assess my heart rate variability? How often do I look at all these parameters and do I utilize that to its full capacity? And if the answer is no, it's like, do I really need to be overloading myself with even more information, especially if it's about the sort of minutiae that I'm not going to take action on? So yeah, I find it interesting. And I think for people who are, you know, for athletes, for people who, perhaps like you, Sophie, because I know you've got all your ducks in a row, like when it comes to lifestyle, you are doing everything right. Yeah, you're doing all the stuff you're meant to do. Then adding more, yes. But until you've got those obvious things sorted, it's best to focus on those.
I have to say, we found the testing thing really interesting, not necessarily for both of us in a positive way. I think you can have, exactly as you've sort of alluded to, too much information. Yeah. And that actually in some cases, not so much mine, but particularly fees, that can give people health anxiety. As you said, you and I have a head start on understanding what we're seeing and being able to rationalize it. And that was definitely useful for me with the results of one of the tests that came back that I knew was not reflective of me and my health. And I was able to get through that in a sensible way. But I think there is so much available now. People get swamped with it and it can actually be a little bit excessive.
Yeah.
I took those tests. We did quite a few. I took mine, I think, 6 months post getting my all clear from breast cancer. And Sophie's exactly right. It did exacerbate the health anxiety that I already had. Yet it was super interesting. And yeah, Sophie, your experience with the Dutch test was particularly interesting. And as you say, because you are a doctor, Sophie, you were able to extrapolate what you needed and look into it more deeply, whereas other people might not do. But it was still, I loved the fact that we did them. I felt like I had a baseline.
Me too. Yeah. And it gave me an insight into, I've never been someone who's just blindly tested things for the sake of it. And I think we live in a society now where these things are accessible to people at home who just decide they want to run a test. This gave me a real insight into both the pros and cons of that I didn't have before.
It can be too much. And just thinking about, again, my patients and the people I tend to look after, and thinking about bigger picture sort of NHS guidelines around lifestyle. So, of course, we know that we should ideally be eating 8 portions of fruit and veg a day. That's what's agreed as the minimum to have really good health. But over the years, the work that I've done with Public Health England, which has helped me understand guidelines, if you say to a family who are struggling to get 1 a day, that they should be aiming for 8 a day, they'll just switch off. If you make it unachievable, people just switch off and they don't even try. So even though, whilst Public Health England recognise that 8 portions a day is really what we should be aiming for, because their guidelines are targeted towards people who are nowhere near the 5 a day, they make it 5 a day. So it feels achievable so people can work towards it. Because actually, if you're already eating 5 a day and you ideally would be moving up to 8, that's not who the guidelines are for. We're not worried about you. We're worried about people who are eating 1 or 0. So I think it just goes to show, if people are overwhelmed with too much information, they can just switch off and decide it's too much, it's overburdening, I'm just not even going to have a go at doing any of it. So I think my advice to people would be, these tests are really interesting, and do explore them, especially if you're somebody who really is looking for those add-ons because you're already really taking great care of yourself. But just ask yourself the question, what will I do with the results? If the outcome is this or this, what will I do next? And if you don't really have a good answer that's beneficial, then it's probably not worth doing it.
Completely agree. We love the story behind how you met your partner, Stuart, totally by chance in a bar in Portugal, and how at the time you were thinking about using a sperm donor to become a mum. And this all now explains why your son is called Lisbon. You've also talked about freezing your eggs aged 38, presumably before you'd met Stuart. So can you pick up the story from here, in particular the reality and the cost around egg freezing? Is it something I considered and decided not to do? And perhaps the emotions and decisions that lay behind this?
Yeah, it was really interesting how the egg freezing came about. So as you rightly said, I was 38 and my mum died that year. and she'd always sort of been on at me. I was in a long-term relationship till 35, and then I was pretty much single for those 3 years. So she was always saying, have you thought about freezing your eggs? Freeze your eggs. I know how much you really want to be a mom and how disappointed you would be if you didn't get to be a mom. Freeze your eggs. And my response was very much like, look, I'm the doctor. I know what I'm doing. It's fine. Anyway, about 3 months after she passed away, I got a phone call from The One Show, and I'd never worked on The One Show before, asking me if I would host a short film about egg freezing. So I was like, oh, okay. How did you know I was thinking about this? I was thinking, how would they know that? And they didn't. And they said, why are you? I said, yes. They said, would you be willing to share that on screen? I said, yes. I'm like, brilliant. We'd love you to come and present this short film for us. As I get older, the scientific side of me is slightly being surpassed by the more mystical, spiritual side, I think. So I do think was that a gift from mum? So I spent the day researching egg freezing. I spoke to people who were for it, against it. I actually even visited the freezer where eggs are kept, where my eggs currently are. I've been there. And at the end of the day, for me, it was very clear that the right thing to do was to freeze my eggs. And it's always important to caveat that with egg freezing absolutely does not guarantee you a child in the future. In fact, I got 7 eggs. It's much more likely that if I was to use my eggs, I wouldn't get a baby than I would. But my decision at the time was based on I didn't want to get to an age where I was no longer able to have a baby naturally and think that there was a regret, there being something I could have done that I didn't do that could have given me a chance. So that's what I based my decision on. And yeah, it was straightforward. The process was absolutely fine. The biggest downside to it absolutely is the cost. So I reckon it's between £4,000 and £5,000 by the time you've paid for everything and all the drugs that you need. But then you've got to pay for storage every year. So I get a £500 bill once a year for keeping my little eggs in there, safely in their little freezer home. So it is expensive, but I know it's something that's getting more and more popular. In fact, I think the biggest rise in fertility treatment in the past few years has been people freezing their eggs. So yeah, absolutely no regrets. I'm really glad I did it. In the end, I didn't need to use them. So I met Stuart the following year. We conceived naturally and we've got our little boy, Lisbon, which is where Stuart and I met, as you said. But you know, now I'm 44 and the chances of me being able to conceive naturally are pretty low. And even if I could, the chances of miscarriage are very high. So I guess now we're in a position where if we wanted to, we could attempt to have a second baby using those eggs, which is something I never thought about at the time. So yeah, so grateful that they're there. And I'm really glad that I did it, even though it was expensive. But before I met Stuart, yeah, I was thinking about, well, I'd started down the path of becoming a solo parent because everybody feels differently about being a mum. My really good friend, Jenny, she always knew she absolutely did not want to be a mum, didn't want to have children. And she still says that. She's been consistent with that and I respect that. But I always knew that I did. And to the point where I almost couldn't imagine what the second half of my life would look like if I wasn't a mum. That's where I was coming from. So for me, yeah, the decision was based on doing everything that I could.
And I think what you say is so important because I think nowadays, as women's opportunities have changed and evolved so much, many women are putting, if they want children, putting it off until a little bit later in life. And there's a lot of them talking about egg freezing as this panacea that can give them the best of everything. When actually, as you say, I think so many people don't realise that it isn't a given. You can have frozen eggs, but that still can mean that you don't have a viable pregnancy from them. And that was where my decision lay. I've never been anti-children, but I also never had the burning need to have my own like you did. And I remember at 36, a good gynecologist friend of mine said to me, so when are we freezing your eggs? And I just said, actually, we're not. And I had given it some serious thought. But I thought, for me, going through having to take hormones, which I didn't really want to take, going through having that procedure and then paying for it and still having no guarantees of success should I decide to use them, I decided on balance, for me, the right thing was not to do it. And if I met someone who I wanted to have children with, then fantastic. But otherwise, I was at peace with it. And I think it's just such an individual decision.
Yeah, it really is. And that's, I think that's, people just need to give it individual thought. If people are thinking about it, I always say to my friends who are perhaps in their late 30s or mid 30s, who are single, because often that is the reason. Yes, people do put it off because they want careers and it's difficult to buy a house until we're older and all those reasons. But for a lot of people, it is just that they haven't met the partner. So I call it social infertility. So I have several friends who are in that same position. And what I always say to them is just go and get your fertility checked, first of all, see where you're at, because that only costs a couple of £100. And they'll do a scan, they'll do a blood test. And what they can tell you is, so one of my friends did that recently. And well, despite her being 37, they said, well, you've actually got, according to these tests, and it is an estimate, it's a guess, but your tests tell us, are more in line with what we'd typically see for a 28-year-old. So she was like, okay, I can afford to wait another couple of years, see if I meet somebody. So she monitors it once a year because her fertility is pretty good. And it also means that if she does want to freeze her eggs, she's probably going to have a good result because her fertility is really good. But equally, I've had other friends who were younger who have found that those parameters are more in line with somebody much older. And that spurred them to think, right, well, I am going to freeze my eggs, just because it gives that extra layer of potential opportunity. But I had a very interesting conversation with Professor Nargund, who owns the clinic that I went to. And she had a son who was turning 30 around the time that I was making this film for the One Show. So a question I asked her was, if your son was actually a daughter, what would you be saying to her about freezing her eggs? And she said, for her 30th birthday, that's what she'd be getting as a gift. I would be paying for her to have egg freezing because it's around the best time of your age to do it, sort of late 20s as you're approaching 30. And she said she sees this world in the future where the cost of egg freezing will come down and women probably in their 20s will self-donate eggs. So what she meant by that is they'll freeze their eggs when they're in their mid-20s. And even if they want to have a baby in their early 30s and they're still able to conceive naturally without any support, they'll choose to use the eggs that they froze when they were younger because there's lower risk of miscarriage, there's lower risk of chromosomal abnormalities. So she, the way she referred to it was, if you bought some chicken from the supermarket that you intended to use in 2 weeks' time, you'd freeze it on day one. You wouldn't leave it in the fridge for 3 days and then freeze it. So the sooner you freeze it, the earlier you freeze it, the better quality it is. And I thought that's a really interesting thing to consider.
We'll put loads of links in the show notes actually so we can support and give some extra information on all of this. It's so interesting. And you've also, Zoe, been beautifully open about your childbirth journey with Lisbon. And if I can just quote you back at you for a moment, as we again loved your interview on thebarnsdoula.com, where you said, as a GP who'd worked in obstetrics and gynecology for 6 months, I started my pregnancy with a very medicalized view of childbirth. I had always thought I'd choose to have an elective C-section as this would be the best way of controlling the birth and ensuring ultimately I didn't have to have an assisted instrumental delivery, which I was keen to avoid. You then described meeting Letty, who would become your doula through a home birth, and described how, and again I'm quoting you, throughout my pregnancy, the doctor inside me got quieter and the maternal side of me got much louder. A lot of women today, from what I'm reading, are very put off having a vaginal birth and the rate of cesareans are higher than they've ever been. I've had both. I had a vaginal birth for my daughter and then a C-section for my twins, electively. What are your thoughts around women being afraid that they'll somehow, quote-unquote, damage their vaginas during delivery? And would you be happy to talk about your experience?
Yeah, absolutely. So I always thought I'd just go for an elective C-section because whilst it's not necessarily, it's not true that you have a easier recovery or any of that, I just thought that way I know what I'm getting and I can plan for it. Mm. And when I was around 6 months pregnant, it was really bizarre. I knew that my body and this baby would be fine with a vaginal birth. And as I then progressed through pregnancy, I started to feel more and more that actually being in hospital would be the very thing that might just affect me negatively, especially because I've worked in hospitals. I feel like when I walk into a hospital, it's going to feel really weird. I don't feel like I could be able to be myself. So I opted for a home birth, but I never said to anyone, I'm having a home birth. I said, I'm planning for a home birth, But I never made the decision that that's what's going to happen, because I didn't want to feel disappointed if I changed my mind a couple of hours into having contractions and wanted to go to hospital. So it's like the only way to have a home birth is to plan for a home birth, but you still have the option of going to hospital available to you. So that's what I planned for. And having a doula, so I had Letty and Lauren, they did a job share, so I had two for the price of one. Honestly, for me, that was exactly what I needed, because they were able to just answer all of my questions. They were able to give me all of the knowledge that I didn't have actually about childbirth. Whilst I had a very medicalized view of it, I knew, you know, how the baby turns and et cetera, et cetera. And I also knew how to intervene with childbirth when there are problems. I had very little experience of what happens physiologically, which is normal. And I actually had a third doula as well. So a lovely lady called Emiliana, who did hypnobirthing training with me. But they taught me about how oxytocin is the really important hormone to keep the childbirth process going along. And then cortisol, the stress hormone, actually has a negative impact. It dampens down the oxytocin. So if you get stressed, it's no wonder that when women arrive at hospital, everything slows down for a period of time, because stress of arriving at hospital, waiting in the corridor, the bright lights, etc. So yeah, it really helped me understand what I needed to do. And so I did have a home birth, and it was really bizarre because I was able to be almost primal. It was almost like I wasn't there. It was very primal. And I felt like I was an observer. I knew that my role was just to tolerate the sensations, we decided to call them rather than call them contractions. My role was to tolerate the contractions, to stay calm, to stay as relaxed as possible, to feel as much love as possible. So anything I could do to create the feeling of love, because I knew that if, as long as I did that, then my body and this baby would do what they needed to do in order for the baby to get out. And that's basically what happened. So he was born at home in a pool. The midwife wasn't there. The midwife was 20 minutes late. So another reason, thank goodness, I had a doula who, whilst they're not trained at helping deliver a baby, and she didn't touch me, she was able to just reassure me. The number of times I must have said, oh my God, Letty, is this normal? And she was just like, absolute textbook, you're doing great, carry on. And then I could go back into my primal state. So it was a really unique and lovely experience, but I wouldn't necessarily recommend doing it without a midwife. I would have preferred a midwife to have been there, definitely.
And I think for me, having done it both ways, my recovery was far harder after the C-section, including my pelvic floor, which I think a lot of women think, actually, your pelvic floor is going to be trickier after a vaginal. Actually, no, after my C-section, maybe because of the weight of the babies, of two babies, but yeah, very interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think you can have a weakened pelvic floor. You will have a weakened pelvic floor, actually, whether you've given birth vaginally or via a C-section, because for all those months, you've put all this extra pressure on all the soft tissues and you've stretched them. And it's not just the typical pelvic floor muscles that we tend to think of, which is that sling that sits underneath our bladder and our bowels and our womb to support it. It's all of the soft tissues inside. Everything has been massively stretched. And it takes a couple of years, really, for it to fully come back. And then, yeah, I know people worry about vaginal laxity as well. And I guess it partly depends, I think, on the individual. Some people definitely do suffer with that and other people don't at all. But yeah, if you follow your advice, best thing to do is follow the advice, pelvic floor exercises during pregnancy and afterwards. And actually, even people who haven't had babies, it's something we all need to be doing, ideally from our 30s onwards.
And this leads us nicely into your work with the Isviva X-Joy Lux device, which is a vaginal device we talked about on our September vagina and vulva episode in relation to how it can support menopausal women experiencing dryness, issues with sexual function and also incontinence issues. We'd love to hear more about it from your perspective, Zoe.
Yeah, so I've been working with Isviva, who are an online hub, really, to support people going through menopause. So they've got loads of information on there. They've got a community where you can meet up with other people online who are going through the same, and they do a lot of campaigning as well for raising the awareness and giving women a voice when talking about menopause. So I've been doing some work with them around that. And yes, there's a device, the Joylux device, which is quite fascinating, actually. They've got a huge amount of evidence now behind this device. It's to be used intravaginally for 10 minutes every other day. It's not even every day. And results are typically experienced from 6 weeks to 12 weeks on. And it uses a combination of red light and infrared light with vibration as well. And it heats up to about 42 degrees. So this combination of light, vibration and heat actually stimulates the tissues to produce more collagen, elastin and glycogen. So as we get older, we naturally have a depletion of collagen, elastin and glycogen. And that's one of the main reasons why women tend to experience vaginal dryness, sexual issues and even incontinence. So this device is a really safe way to try and combat that. And on the website, I know some of the testimonials that have really jumped out at me are literally people saying it's life-changing, people saying that their vaginal function is better than when they were in their 20s. So it's an option for women, especially for women who are experiencing symptoms due to menopause, who don't want to take HRT or can't take HRT and have vaginal symptoms. Of course, it is safe to also use the vaginal HRT, the topical estrogen, for those women. But it's an option. I guess it's also an option. It's not something I've necessarily been working with them or seen them promoting it. But I think following childbirth, as long as you've had sufficient time to heal properly, if people do have vaginal laxity, it's something that can treat that as well. It's technology at its best, isn't it? Helping us deal with those issues. And I think there's still so much taboo and stigma around talking about these things that it's always good to talk about it and let people know that these types of devices are there to help.
And we'll link into that in the show notes. And we'll also link into, Sophie, your vagina and vulva episode, which is one of your most popular, not surprisingly, because as you said, Zoe, often we don't talk about these things or we talk about them at surface level.
Yeah.
So we've talked about vaginal skincare, something that's been so overlooked in medical literature. What about face and body skincare, Zoe? What is your usual routine? We would love it if you name checked any favorite products. And also, what about any in-clinic treatments and tweakments? Are you at that point yet or at all?
I've dabbled. So in terms of skincare, so I've always moisturized my face and my whole body since I was a teenager, I think. I naturally have very dry skin. So if I don't, my skin feels tight and uncomfortable. So yeah, I'm always really consistent with that. I'm now in my mid-40s, so I have got to an age where I'm investing a little bit more in skincare that actually works. I'm very lucky. I've never really suffered with acne or rosacea or much pigmentation or any issues other than just dryness. I know so many people who spend hundreds of pounds on skincare every month and they're choosing products based on a social media influencer or what their mate uses or what they read in a magazine, and that's not tailored to you. So if you're going to spend a decent amount of money on your skin, it's just worth spending that little bit extra to get a consultation with somebody who's an expert to make sure that you're spending it wisely. So things that I love, I won't talk too much about the things that are prescribed for me because that's not necessarily relevant for everybody, but I do use a retinol because I believe that's the number one thing that makes a difference. And I've been working with Estee Lauder recently, doing a lovely campaign with them, which is all about celebrating aging. So the Advanced Night Repair, which is something I've used for years, which is one of my favourite products of theirs. Interesting to know, when you get to work with a brand, you get to see the actual science. And I think that's a product of theirs. They've done a lot of work on developing and fine-tuning, and it's a really good product. And I always use it if I'm going on an aeroplane as well. And I'm also, at the moment, I'm also using their Revitalizing Supreme Day and Night Cream, which is a tip that I use. Having very dry skin, I often use the night cream in the day because night cream tends to be much oilier and thicker. So whilst that wouldn't work for everybody, for me, my skin just soaks it up. So I often use a night cream in the day. And then all body as well. So I always moisturize my body every day. I'm loving the Sol de Janeiro Brazilian bum cream into that at the moment. So I asked my dad to buy it me for Christmas and he did, and he wrapped it up and he said, "You might not want to open this in front of everybody. I got you the bum cream." I was like, "No, mum, no, dad, it's not bum cream." He was like, "I didn't understand." So yes, I'm using that as a body moisturizer, but I can't use it once my Christmas supply runs out. It's a bit pricey to use all over the body every day. I actually use an emollient a couple of times a week. I use QV as an emollient because my skin is so dry. So yeah, that sort of just keeps the dryness under control. So I've never had a filler. And actually, when I was a GP trainee, I did my Botox training. So following that I was always the one, because I was becoming a doctor when I was at uni, my friendship group always said, look, when we get to 30, we're probably going to need Botox. So I was nominated as a person to be able to train and administer. Mm-hmm. So I did do it for a couple of years, but then I've stopped and I haven't done it since. So I myself have had Botox a handful of times, and I've had Profhilo as well. So that's something in recent years, but I actually haven't had anything now for, I think, over a year. Maybe it's time to explore it again, because I am starting now to get I've always just had fine lines around my eyes, but I am now starting to get some lines on my forehead and stuff. So maybe it's time.
I'd love to know, through your TV work, if any makeup artists have given you any amazing tips, and also what products you find from a makeup perspective really work for your skin.
I'm sure they have given me lots of tips over the years. I tend to just get either, when I'm in the makeup chair, I'm doing one of two things. I'm chatting about life generally, and because the girls at This Morning have become really good friends over the years, we're generally just having a good old chinwag catch up, and I don't pay too much attention to what they're doing, just let them do their thing. Or sometimes early in the morning, I'll just have a little snooze. I'll sit in that chair and have my face lightly stroked. So what tips? Definitely my eyebrows. They've really helped me figure out how best, because I've got very flyaway, untamed eyebrows. They've helped me manage that. But yeah, tips-wise, I should probably, that'd be a good use of my time with them, actually, would be to start taking more notice of what they do and getting some tips. So yeah. I'm going to do that one. In terms of product, I love, my foundation is Lisa Eldridge. And it's a brand that I didn't really know until a few years ago. And I like things the old-fashioned way. So I met my partner in a bar, good old-fashioned way to meet someone. And the way I came to this, to Lisa Eldridge, they have a beautiful store in Covent Garden. And I was just looking at all their range of foundations. And this lovely lady, this gorgeous lady in the shop, came and offered me some help and started talking to me about my skin tones and how I should never use a foundation that has pink or orange, but always go for golds and creams and blah, blah, blah. And she actually taught me quite a bit about my skin. And she said, do you want me to see which one works for you? And I bought it, and I've bought it ever since. And I think partly because of her kindness, and also it does really just make my, I can use just a tiny amount of it, and it just really suits my skin. It feels really nice on my skin. So again, I think it's such a personal thing, isn't it? I've tried lots of different foundations over the years, and I'll probably stick with this one for life now, I imagine.
You know that it works, yeah.
Yeah. And then for colour, I am a MAC fan. I've always been a MAC fan. I do find having dark skin that the pigments in their colours are much better. So about a good proportion of my makeup bag is MAC.
MAC, yeah. So exercise, which you've said is a huge part of your life. And I know that while at medical school, you got into rugby and played in the Premiership Division, which is so impressive. You're also an ex-gladiator. I can't believe we haven't mentioned this yet. Also impressive. So we can see from our research that you continue to love rugby as well as cycling and HIIT. We wonder, though, how your exercise regime has changed as you've become older, particularly, again, in relation to perimenopause and bone health.
Well, my exercise regime has changed a lot. So I love rugby, but it's watching it these days. It's not playing. Gladiators. I love the new series of Gladiators. Oh, I absolutely love it. And it does, of course, remind me of the days that I spent being Amazon. So I'm someone who's, I've always loved exercising. I'm really lucky that I've enjoyed it, and I've always been fit and I've always been strong. But the last year and a half, I've had real issue with my back. So I've got very degenerative discs, I've got bulging discs. So I just haven't been able to do the things that I love. I love to lift weights, I love to run. Going for a run is sort of my meditation, really, because I struggle with slow, still meditation, and I haven't been able to do it. And it's been really challenging, it's been really difficult for me. So I've been having various different procedures. I'm desperately trying to avoid having surgery on my back, but it's becoming a reality that I may need to go down that path. And it's also becoming a reality that, unfortunately for me, I might not be able to do things that are high impact again because of the issues with my back. So I've been doing Pilates and yoga and spin cycling, and I've really had to change it up. And I think it just goes to show that life happens. And when it comes to exercise, whilst I'll always do some form of exercise because I need it, we don't always have a choice. And for me, at this stage in my life where inevitably perimenopause is either approaching or maybe even here, I would love to be lifting heavy weights and putting force through my bones and my joints, because it's more important for me to do that now than ever with the risks of osteoporosis and obviously losing muscle mass naturally because of my age. But I just can't. So doing what I can, and I'm, you know, my brain goes to at the moment, if I really can't get back to doing all those things that I love, then maybe I'll become a Pilates instructor, like throw myself into it fully. And maybe actually that will be the thing that will, if I throw myself into it fully, maybe my back will recover to a point that these other things may become an option again. I don't know.
I have to say, I think reformer Pilates is one of my favourite forms of exercise. I added it in last summer into a routine that's a lot of strength training, a lot of tennis, boxing at the time as well. I just love reformer. Has upped my strengths. I'm very flexible anyway, but it's just given me a stability I didn't have before.
You do get really strong, don't you? It's a different type. You know, you're not necessarily going to develop big muscles like you do from whacking 40 kilos above your head, but it's a different type of strength. And yeah, I'm very aware that for somebody with a back issue like mine, that is the thing that my body needs.
Yeah. Can we do a few quick fire questions?
Of course.
What helps you de-stress and what helps you to sleep?
Ooh, what helps me de-stress? Oh, do you know what helps me de-stress? And again, it shows how individual we are. Just watching TV, because I've got a very busy brain. My brain's never got one thing in it at a time. And if I read a book, I'm always thinking about things. If I listen to a podcast, I'm always thinking about things. But if I watch TV, I don't know if it's something about looking and listening, then I can fully focus on just that and it switches me off. So I tend to try and squeeze in half an hour to an hour of TV before bed. So, okay. Yeah.
Well, I'm going to ask two quick fire questions then. Do you have a signature fragrance? But also, can you recommend a TV show?
Ooh, okay. Signature fragrance. So my, it's run out actually. I need to restock it. But my fragrance is Maison Francis Coeur de Jean Paris, if that's how you pronounce it. The Gentle Fluidity. That's my signature fragrance. But another fragrance that I'm into for daytime only, it's called Forest Lungs. And it's actually meant to be quite good for your health. It's got, I can't remember what they're called now, but it basically smells like a forest. So sometimes during the day, if it's just me, I'll wear that as well. I recommend a TV show. Gladiators, obviously.
Obviously.
My favorite TV show on TV at the moment. I'm a massive Strictly fan as well. But something I've watched recently, I love the Harlan Coben.
They're great, aren't they?
So good. And I totally leave my brain and like get fully immersed in them. And I've tried to stop. I love Gangs of London, but I've tried to stop watching that sort of stuff because it's not good for the other thing you asked about, the sleep. It's just not really good for us, is it? It's like, why would you watch that and then go to bed? You want your brain to be happy when you go to bed. So watching Michael McIntyre before bed is the best thing to do because he is very so he's got a point there. But yeah, I'd recommend the Harlan Cobens. Good British dramas.
Agreed. Can you recommend us either an app or someone to follow on Instagram that you find inspiring?
I tell you who really inspires me on Instagram, Rochelle Humes. Again, it won't be for everybody, but I just think, okay, if Rochelle's doing it, I want to do it. Now that is somebody who really does keep a lot of plates spinning. So Rochelle inspires me. I have a little check of her Instagram every day. An app, I'm a big fan of the Flow app, the period app. If people have periods and don't have that app, it's a real good one because I have the Garmin as well. So I monitor my periods on there. And I'm really into this idea of cycle hacking. I don't know if you've done an episode on that, but recognizing how the four different phases of our menstrual cycle kind of all have pros and cons, sort of superpowers and downsides. So for example, during the ovulatory phase, we're actually more attractive to the other sex. We walk with more swagger, we're more radiant and we're more confident. So if you're planning a party, you should whack it in when you're in that phase of your cycle.
I love it.
Equally, the luteal phase is when there's more progesterone around, so we're just a bit more chilled and a bit more calm. So if we need to have like difficult conversations at work or with family members or partners, might be where we're a bit more level-headed. Definitely not the right time to have those conversations is premenstrual cycle, when your estrogen and progesterone are both coming down at the same time, which means you lose that confidence of the estrogen, you lose the calmness of the progesterone, and that's when we tend to have all those premenstrual symptoms. So we might just burst into tears, a bit less able to have control over our emotions. So I just think that's really fascinating that for all our lives as women, it's almost been like our menstrual cycle has been a downside compared to men, because we have to deal with the period and we have to deal with the fluctuating hormones. Whereas now it's like, hang on a minute, can we actually turn this to our advantage as long as we plan our diary in association? So the Flow app can help you, FLO can help you do that.
Brilliant. We will link it in. Can you recommend a hotel, a spa and a restaurant?
Ooh, a hotel, a spa and a restaurant. Hotel, somewhere we went last year in the UK, in the Cotswolds. It's called Lakes by You, Y-double-O. It's really expensive, but it is absolutely lovely. So if people are able to, we stayed in a 4-bedroom place on the lake. So if there's enough of you to get together, it's a great way for friends to come together and spend a couple of nights there. There's loads of activities that you can do, kayaking on the lake. They've got bikes there. It's just beautiful. I found that a couple of nights there really resets me and calms me and gets me into a good headspace. So that's one that people may not have heard of. Spa. The only spa I ever get to is the spa at my gym. I'm a David Lloyd member. And yeah, and they're just great, aren't they? You can do everything there. You can go and use it. I use it as my office. I sometimes use it as my changing room. If I'm in central London and I've got a meeting, I'll just go to the gym to get changed. I use it as a gym, obviously, occasionally. I use the spa. They've got a soft play, so I'll sometimes take Lisbon there. They've got a decent restaurant and bar. So yeah, and they've got lovely, they tend to have really lovely spas, so... So that would be my spa recommendation. So, and restaurant. Tell you where I went recently that was one of the best nights out I've had in a long time. Sheesh Restaurant, which is in Mayfair. And on a Wednesday night, and it's got to be a Wednesday night, if you go upstairs and you have to book it, it's a really great party. So they have DJ Melody Kane on the decks, and then they have Kelly LaRocque, who's just the most fabulous singer, singing with her band. It's just a proper night out. The food is absolutely delicious. It's not cheap, but you get a massive party thrown in for free. So that's a good one.
Besides family and friends, can you tell us about a woman who you admire?
I think a woman that I really, really admire and I would love to meet one day is Oprah Winfrey.
Oh, she's amazing, yeah. Oh.
Just... We could all just do with being a little bit more Oprah, couldn't we? And she's someone who I guess has inspired me since I was a little girl. And she used to, back in the day when she used to have her talk shows, and just used to think, oh gosh, she's so wise. Oh, that's a good point. I feel like I've learned quite a lot from her. So she is someone that I've always consistently throughout my life admired. Michelle Obama's another one. I just think, what a woman. Oh, she's so great.
She's consistently on my list of people I'd invite to a dinner party.
Yeah. Because she's so funny as well. Like, she's just, I just love her. I feel like she's somebody who, despite all the pressures probably not to be herself, she shows up as a self, like a real sort of genuine self, even when there must be so much pressure on her to act or be a certain way. I really respect and admire that.
Completely agree. Thank you so much, Zoe. I've loved this chat. So many great tips, so much wonderful, honest conversation. And for any of you who don't already follow Zoe over on socials, it's at Dr. Zoe Williams. And we'll link into the Clear Minds podcast on the show notes, along with some more information.
Thank you.
And that ends this week's podcast. If you want to find out more about me and my work, or maybe book a consultation, head to drsophieschotter.com and you can find me on socials at drsophieschotter. And again, thank you so much for listening.